be seated. Our final case today is case number 67966, Kelly versus State. Mr. Stewart, Mr. Mills.
Hello, my name is Roger Stewart. I'm the Chief Deputy of the Elko County Public Defender's Office. I'm here for Michael Kelly, Father Garnes.
Mr. Stewart, can I ask you one question at the beginning, one factual issue? I want to make sure I understand.
Sure.
Ms. Megan Askins, was she living at the same residence as Mr. Kelly when this incident took place?
Yes.
Okay, so she was there, and who rented it? Was it his place or her place or jointly? Or was that ever part of the record in the case?
I'm not even sure it was part of the record she was living there. I happen to know that.
Okay. Well, that I won't ask you.
You stumped me on the second one.
Okay. Well, I didn't see it in the record, so I just thought maybe you could help me out on that. But thank you.
Now, I guess this is one of those cases that if we weren't doing it here, and possibly even though we are doing it here, it still may end up on somebody's criminal procedure hypothetical. We certainly got a number of interesting issues here. And the court, of course, raised the one that probably is the most interesting about it. I think the way to understand the cases that the court asked us to analyze subsequently is to remember that at a certain point the judge below had indicated that one, regardless of the legitimacy of the original searches with regard to the first police officer there, that he believed that they had a right to be searching the shed out there, and that they had a right to, I guess under the, he phrases it under the emergency doctrine. Now, one of the things that I think we, the defense, disagreed with most thoroughly there is the fact that if you look at that, it really seems to be in view of, I always forget whether it's McNeely versus Missouri or vice versa, but the McNeely case, it seems to be that that case was the case that we like the analysis that talks a great deal about the special needs analysis. And this really does seem like a special needs analysis rather than any kind of emergency. The most that one police officer says about it at that time is that he heard a rustling in the shed. They had already at that point, I guess this was the third time that guns were taken out, one by the first police officer after he had gotten the consent from the woman in the vehicle. The second time when they searched the house again by both police officers, and the third time after the rustling in the shed.
Now, does it make any difference to that second search that when the second officer arrived, he indicated that Mr. Kelly was a probationer?
We don't think it does in the long run here, because if you look below, among other things, in the original opposition brief of Mr. Lowe, he indicates that he is expecting at the motion to suppress to put on the probation officer who would have said, yes, we would have said for them to search it if they had called us up. However, one, that officer was not put on, and two, apparently they were not called up about it. So that while there are references at various points to the fact that certainly I would think the majority of probations in the state of Nevada involve no liquor clauses, even if, like Mr. Kelly, you were convicted of a drug charge. And likewise, they involve good conduct charges. But the conspicuous thing that they did not do was to check up on that. It's interesting.
So that was the probation agreement that Mr. Kelly signed, which all the ones I've ever seen for this would have a consent to search for liquor or narcotics or whatever, because while they're on probation, that was never brought into evidence?
It was actually submitted as evidence in the suppression motion. However, if you look at the document itself, it says that you submit to the Department of Parole and Probation doing it, or by, I think they say, their designee, or it's one of those words.
Okay.
The conspicuous thing that they did not do was to call up and be a designee, despite the fact that the second officer apparently had some knowledge of this. So it would have been a pretty quick phone call to probably get that if they wanted to. I guess one of the other things that,
Mr. Stewart?
If I can
go... Mr. Stewart, I'm sorry, just a quick question. Would Ms. Askins' consent to search the home include the shelter, include the shed?
Obviously not. The shed's a separate building outside. She was asked to, if they could look around in the home. They conspicuously did that twice, and then they went outside and were kind of glancing around. I don't think it would include the shed, which would be, you know, a separate building there. Moreover, the circumstances of it would make that a little bit odd anyway.
Would that be considered part of the curtilage?
I think you could do that, but remember, we're talking about a drunken woman who has been naked in the car before, and I venture to say that the first time she might ever hear the word curtilage would be if she came today, which, so far as I know, she's not. The other thing is, now, with regard to this, I think one easy way to understand sort of what's at stake here is to ask ourselves what could have been done instead. And I went through one of them, and that was parole and probation could have been contacted. Easy. Another thing, and again, there are some disputed facts in this, but we have the idea that, according to some versions, the car was either completely in the carport, or alternatively, maybe it wasn't, okay? And we have the idea that you open the door, you do a threshold, basically, as in the Howe case from here in Nevada, you basically have begun a search at that point. Now, at various times, the appellee here has tried to distinguish this on basis of the idea that my client would not have standing. Well, no. He drove the car. This was apparently his home. You had to either be in the carport or quite near the carport to be doing it. So, depending on how you feel about carports, and certainly there's a great deal to be said for even the prosecution's cases that say that walking into a carport was okay, and one can, I'm trying to give a balanced presentation here, one could even argue that, gee, there was a doorbell there. Well, then, gee, why not, instead of opening up the vehicle, which my client clearly has standing to challenge, why not ring the doorbell to see if he was there? Likewise, the other things that could have been done was, there was the more normal entrance that most people would make to this place, which would have been on the porch there. And again, if we look at the cases that I stress a good deal, Roberts and Threat, from the analysis in the Thompson case, it seems that when the police are entering there, and when they're entering without permission there, much as they're entering, certainly at the very least, the shed here, that was improper without exigent circumstances. Now, as I looked at the...
I assume the shed was on the same parcel of property. It wasn't a different address or a different piece of property.
That's correct, yeah.
Well, let me ask you one other thing, too, on the maybe the unusual set of facts here that it appears from the evidence, and Judge Kaysen's ruling that Mr. Kelly was hiding there in the shed and he's trying to circumvent the police investigation there on purpose and all like that, and they heard the ruffling around. Isn't that an exigent circumstance there that the police acted properly to pry him out of there and proceed from there?
A good question, Your Honor. The reason that we maintain that it's not, and again, if you read the Roberts analysis that we submitted and the threat analysis that we submitted, certainly those people had the similar kinds of things that they were arguing were exigent circumstances there. And court, I believe it's in threat, notes, hey, there were two policemen, they could have gotten a warrant. Likewise, in the MacArthur analysis that the appellee stresses for why Welsh versus Wisconsin doesn't apply. And I agree with that part, Welsh versus Wisconsin. That's basically toast. I mean, we're in the 21st century now. But the key thing is that in MacArthur, they did that very thing that the threat court was suggesting. They would not allow the person to do anything else. Okay, I think in that case he wanted to go inside his home. Here, they could simply have not allowed him to do anything else with regard to that shed and gotten the warrant. And remember the time frames here. The first policeman gets there approximately 10 minutes after the two people who have followed this couple have called it in. So time is not really too much of a factor here. Now again, there's some mention of, well, Mr. Kelly went to court and at trial raised a last gulp defense. Well, I don't think that the fact that a person may raise a last gulp defense indicates that all of a sudden dissipation is now a valid reason for undermining the exigent circumstances requirement. Like many people, I think here, I was very surprised by the McNeely decision. I thought that they would go with something like, they have a driving privilege in this state, therefore they gotta give blood. But instead, they have cut down that part, that special needs for DUI. Now there still is, in part, some special needs for DUI, that seem to be eminently valid in McNeely, meaning the one that's right in front of all of our noses, which is, well, if you want to do breath, you have to do it. If you don't want to do blood, we can get the warrant for you. But again, getting the warrant for him was probably no big deal in this case. Likewise, going back to Judge Kaysen's essentially thinking that it was kind of irrelevant what had happened earlier. Remember that almost all the cases that we, the appellant, have cited indicate points where someone went over the line, someone went over some kind of threshold with some kind of search, and that which followed was therefore illegal. And that's really important here. The other thing I found is kind of strange is the way that the appellee phrases it with regard to issue 5, that they are talking about the exigent circumstances exception. I suppose we can tap dance around that and think that that's okay English for the law here. But the bottom line is it's an exigent circumstances requirement, just as it's a probable cause requirement. And we've cited many cases that seem to indicate that when the officers get there, if they don't have the exigent circumstances, even though they do have the probable cause, they have to take other action. And I think that that's right for DUIs. I think the idea that DUIs are obviously very, very serious crimes and such, but particularly whereas here we have a time frame where these people are doing a very good job of getting everything done timely, but they're not doing the things that don't involve opening places, not knocking on places, bringing out guns to go places and seizing places when they can get warrants rather easily within the time frame. So that we don't think that there can be an exigent circumstances exception to DUI when, as here, it ends up that we're at the home. Certainly there would be some exigent circumstances, highly arguable, and again, we're trying to give a balanced presentation here. The exigent circumstances would be highly arguable in hot pursuit, and of course, they would be there for your normal automotive exception by the side of the road, that kind of thing. Thank you very much.
How many doors on the shed?
Pardon me?
How many doors on the shed?
Oh, only one that I know of. Thank you.
Mr. Lowe.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court and counsel. Now, there's a lot of issues in this case, so I think what I'll do is tailor my argument towards some of the questions that the court has asked and some of the concerns that the court might have based on those questions. First of all, to get to your first question, it is in the record in two different places, by my count, that the girlfriend, Ms. Askins, and Mr. Kelly were living together. I'd refer the court to the appellant's appendix, pages 32 and 122. And that's extremely important because if she's living there and she has standing to, or not standing, but she has the ability to grant consent. And so the state's view of this case is that this is a straightforward issue of consent as to all of the different pieces that were searched. And if the court finds that there wasn't consent, then it's an even clearer case of exigent circumstances. So first, with regards to the consent, and this plays into the curtilage questions as well. They're all interrelated. And so the girlfriend gives Officer Hildreth consent to search the house. And in fact, if you look at the record, she actually accompanied him through the house. She joined him for the search. She walked him through the house. So there was consent to search the house. Then Officer Gustafson shows up, and they get consent again to search the house again. Now, the issue of curtilage is important because if the carport is deemed to be curtilage and if the shed is deemed to be curtilage, and you look at United States versus Oliver from 1984 and all of the other U.S. Supreme Court case law on the curtilage doctrine, and it says that if something is deemed to be curtilage, then what that means is that it's considered a part of the house for Fourth Amendment purposes. So what does that mean? If consent is granted to search the house, that means consent is also granted to search the curtilage of the house. So clearly that applies to the carport, and arguably, as the respondent just acknowledged, would even potentially extend to the shed. So it's a straightforward issue of consent. And if the court finds consent, then there's no need to even get to an exigency analysis because consent is an exception to the Fourth Amendment. You don't need a warrant or exigency or any other kind of justification if there's consent. So that's point number one, just a straightforward consent analysis. She lived there with him. She had standing to grant that consent.
Did the police ask her, may we search the shed?
They did not. They asked for consent to search the house. Yep.
But after they searched the house, did they say, by the way, can we search the shed? They didn't do that.
They did not do that. That's correct. And here's another point. Officer Hildreth testified that in order to access the house, they had to go through the carport. They went through the carport in order to access the house. And
they could have went through the front door.
Correct. Okay. Made clear in the record that there was another entrance to the house.
The question is, the carport had a door, but there was a front door and a front porch on the opposite. I saw the pictures in the record. So one side's the carport, the other side is the front door, so to speak, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And what I was saying is that the testimony of the record indicates that in order to access the house, everybody was going in and out of the carport door. And if you look at the Supreme Court or the case law on the topic of the curtilage doctrine and whatnot, it talks about how it doesn't matter which route they take or which door they go to. If it's a place where, you look at the cases and they talk about, the back door and the front door, and it doesn't matter the route that the person takes to get to the door. And in this case, you've got a doorbell right next to that door in the carport. The carport is open. You look at the factors, the curtilage doctrine factors under Dunn. and the measures taken to protect the area from passersby who might look in there. And you look at the photographs, and I think these are in the record, but you can see clearly into that carport. But either way, so if it's not curtilage, then they had a right to be there. If it is curtilage, then what the state would argue is that the consent to search the home automatically applies to any curtilage, because the Supreme Court has said that that's what curtilage is part of the home.
Well, let me ask you, Erica, let's jump to the next issue. Okay, there's evidence that Mr. Kelly's hiding in the shed. The police pry him out, they get him out, then they start to feel sobriety. Under McNeely, why wouldn't they have called in for a search warrant to administer the DUI test to him? Okay. Now, granted, he wasn't in the car. I mean, he finished there. But what's your interpretation of McNeely on that piece of the case? Yeah.
And McNeely's clear, right, that in McNeely, the U.S. Supreme Court did, in fact, hold that the dissipation of the alcohol in somebody's blood, that by itself, that alone, does not per se constitute an exigent circumstance to do away with the warrant requirement. This case is clearly distinguishable from the run-of-the-mill roadside DUI that would occur in a case like McNeely, where the person is always in the presence of the officer. And the difference in this case is the fact that the guy went into his house and then into the shed. And so in the state of Nevada, as in a lot of states, there's something called the last gulp defense. So it risks the corruption of evidence, because if the person goes into the shed or in the house and consumes alcohol after having driven the car, then the alcohol results aren't any good at that point, because he can claim, well, yeah, I had alcohol in my system, but I consumed the alcohol after I drove, not before.
So your position is he exited the car, went into the house, the shed, whatever, so he wasn't a driver of the vehicle anymore at that point in time, so therefore the McNeely procedures don't apply. Is that
it? McNeely still, I mean, it still applies in the sense that just the dissipation of alcohol alone, that by itself doesn't constitute an exigent
circumstance. Okay, well, we get that, but what about, explain to me why the search warrant shouldn't have been obtained based on these facts.
Because to do so would risk him consuming additional alcohol after driving the vehicle, which would corrupt the evidence. And the California v. Thompson has a discussion of that concern, that it does risk the elimination of evidence and the corruption of evidence. If somebody's not in the presence of the officer, you don't know what they're doing, and they could confuse the alcohol results by consuming additional alcohol inside the house or inside the shed. So that, on top of the dissipation of alcohol, creates a clear exigent circumstance to pull the guy out as soon as possible in order to continue the DUI investigation.
But then would that analysis apply to, and I'm sorry, were you done? Well, that analysis then applied it to just the home. So if Askins had not consented, based on the information and, you know, what I understand your arguments to be, they could have entered the home to go get this guy, because it was that he could be drinking, his blood, it's dissipating, so they could convert that tip on the street into a warrantless entry into the home based solely on exigency.
That's absolutely correct. 100% correct. And this is why this is different from Welsh v. Wisconsin. This is where you get into the gravity of the underlying offense analysis. Welsh v. Wisconsin, in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court said it's the exigent circumstance exception, or exigent circumstances would rarely, if ever, apply to a scenario where an officer enters somebody's home in the middle of the night and to arrest them for a non-jailable traffic offense. And since then, the U.S. Supreme Court clarified in Illinois versus MacArthur that, yeah, that's the distinction we were drawing in that case, jailable versus non-jailable offense. We got 21 cases on the one hand, including the California case and the 20 cases that it cites, saying that, yes, it is an exigent circumstance to enter somebody's home to effect an arrest for a DUI. The difference being that Wisconsin in 1984 made the astounding or amazing decision, in the words of Justice Blackmun, to categorize a first offense DUI as a mere civil offense punishable by a fine only. And that's distinguishable from all of those 21 cases where the DUIs in those states were, it's a criminal offense, just as it is in Nevada. You know, in the words of the respondent just now, DUI obviously is a very, very serious offense. I agree with that. And that's the difference between Welsh and Wisconsin. And that's why, because it's a serious offense, yes, there would be exigent circumstances. Had that been the case in this case, where the guy had been in his bedroom, in his bed, they would have been justified, even without consent, they would have been justified in going in there.
Now, this was, from what I understand, it seems like this was a third offense DUI and it was a felony. Is that?
That's correct. Yes, that's correct. And just out of fairness to the record and whatnot, I don't believe the officers knew that at the time. So that doesn't, I think, factor into their state of mind at the time. They didn't realize that it was going to turn out to be a third offense. That they, if for purposes of their mindset, they thought it was a misdemeanor DUI. But yes, it did turn out to be a felony.
Aside from the last Gulf defense, is there any other exigent circumstances of this? I mean, if anybody's hiding, you never need a warrant. Is that what it is? You never need a warrant to go in to a building if somebody's hiding or you think they're hiding? Is that an exigent circumstance?
Potentially, an additional exigent circumstance that the district court found is the possibility of danger to the public.
What about obtaining search warrants in Elko? How does that work? Can you do it by phone? Please do it by phone?
Yes, they do routinely. After McNeely, that's pretty standard.
In the motion to suppress, was that discussed with the police officer as to why he didn't get a warrant?
I do not believe that that specifically was brought up.
Was there an evidentiary hearing?
Yes, there was.
So did the defense argue at the motion to suppress that the officer should have obtained a warrant?
I don't know if he explicitly argued that, but that's certainly the implication. Because obviously if there was a warrant, we wouldn't be here talking about any of these issues. So that's the clear implication, is that they're arguing there should have been a warrant. And again, the state's position is that consent, and if not consent, then clear exigency, based on all of the stuff we've talked about. And here's another important distinction between Welsh and this case. In Welsh, they're talking about, just look at the facts of that case. And again, the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment, the Supreme Court has reiterated time and again, is reasonableness. In Welsh, they went into somebody's house in the middle of the night, dragged him out of bed literally naked, to arrest him for a civil offense that did not have any kind of criminal penalty associated with it. In this case, we're talking about ordering somebody out of a shed in the backyard under all of the circumstances that you're aware of. Vastly different facts. And then, again, the huge distinction between Welsh, Wisconsin v. Welsh and the DUI in Nevada is that Nevada takes DUIs very seriously. Not only is it a misdemeanor, but it's an aggravated misdemeanor. The Nevada legislature has mandated mandatory prison or jail time for a DUI offense. If there's elevated penalties for a DUI the way there is for not many other misdemeanors, just DUIs and domestic violence offenses, the legislature has deemed those so serious that there's mandatory additional penalties.
Mr. Mills, at best, though, at the time of this contact, didn't the officers at best have reasonable suspicion to detain? You have a citizen saying he's driving poorly. I see him drinking a beer. That's certainly not probable cause to arrest necessarily at that point. Where are we on kind of the spectrum of the contact?
I actually think we're comfortably on the other side of probable cause. Look at the facts that the officers. Clearly they had reasonable suspicion to conduct an investigation under Terry, but I would submit that they had probable cause to arrest, based on the facts that were communicated to them. So they got civilians saying, I saw this guy holding a beer while driving a car, literally drinking and driving. I saw him swerving all over the road into an oncoming lane of traffic. I saw a naked woman crawl across the back seat and pull a beer out of a cooler. We followed them home and they parked in the carport or under the carport or in the driveway. And I saw him get out of the car with a beer in hand and stumble and go into the house. The officers showed up, talked to the female in the car, who corroborated, yes, we've been drinking. Based on all of that, I don't see how that's not probable cause. But at a minimum, as you say, it's reasonable suspicion, but I would say we're comfortably into that arena of probable cause at this point. Now, they chose not to immediately arrest him when they took him out of the shed. I know it's been argued that was a de facto arrest, but the fact of the matter is they immediately reholstered their guns and conducted a DUI investigation, did field sobriety tests, conducted additional investigation to strengthen their case. But I think based on all those facts I just described and that they were aware of, they could have arrested him right on the spot. So this issue of de facto arrest or not is kind of a non-issue because they had probable cause. But even if they didn't, it's okay to use a firearm in the course of a Terry stop detention temporarily, given the particular circumstances, especially in this case where the guy's hiding in a shed. Officer Gustafson testified, I didn't know what was in there. It could be rakes or shovels or other tools. I don't know what kind of weapons are in there, and the guy's hiding from them. It's totally reasonable to take out those firearms temporarily, and then when they see he's not armed, they reholster the firearms and continue with their DUI investigation.
Now, the district court didn't decide this matter on consent, correct? They decided it on exigency, and that they were basically in a place to make these observations.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. And the state's raising that additional observation that you've got this, a person whose house it is saying, go ahead and search it. Twice she gives consent. She goes through with them and searches it with them. And all this other stuff we're talking about is arguably curtilage. And if you look at the reasonableness of the overall conduct of the officers and you look at the intrusion that we're talking about, again, they didn't even go in there and search somebody's shed and go through their personal things. They ordered a man who was hiding to evade a DUI out of the shed. That's what we're talking about. That's vastly different from Welsh, from going into somebody's bedroom and pulling them out of bed.
If they had just come up and you said they could see through to the backyard, I'm sorry, Chief.
Yeah, sure. Uh-huh.
And the guy's sitting in his backyard, and let's agree that's his backyard, it's bounded. Would it be your position they could just walk into his backyard without permission and arrest him right there based on the facts we had now?
Yes. I think it's a chain link fence in this case. Okay. It's open to the public, and I think if they observed him in the backyard, I'm not sure that would fall within the curtilage doctrine to be just in an open space in the backyard, and I think they could go in and arrest him, even without consent or a warrant or whatnot. I believe I'm out of time. If there are no further questions, I'll end there.
Court thanks both counsel for their argument in this matter, and the pleading is submitted. This matter will stand.